I'm going to get very pastor here and talk about the Lord of the Rings. Tolkien's book, and probably I think what is one of the cruxes of his whole storytelling, is around the concept of power. I mean, the ring is the ring of power. And there's a memorable scene where Frodo has this ring, this ring of power that he's trying to get to the mountain to destroy and all that. But you have these like powerful yet good characters in the story. You have people like Galadriel or Gandalf, Mithrandir. You have these characters who, like, are, for all intents and purposes, are wonderful and are already incredibly powerful. But both of them go through this incredible test. Like, Galadriel's this powerful elf queen, and she initially contemplates, Frodo's like willing to part with this ring in some ways. And she envisions herself having this immense power to be feared and adored by all. But with her serene strength, she actually rejects the ring, and she says to herself, I passed the test. I will diminish and go to the west. And the same thing happens to Gandalf. He actually contemplates the good he can do with all of this power, the power that the ring offered. There's this quick moment of test right at the beginning of the story. And he passes the test. He doesn't take the ring in that moment. Understanding what power can do. And perhaps it's a picture that Tolkien wants us to paint for us that actually has a lot more to do with the themes, I think, that the text deals with today. The disciples are meant to see the nature of authority and power and how the world uses it and how his kingdom is just something different. So let's pick up. We encounter his third teaching, as I said, where he speaks about the fact he's going to Jerusalem and that he's going to die. And as he was going up, he took the 12 aside, and on the way he said to them, see, we are going to Jerusalem. Son of Man will be given over to the chief priests and scribes, will be condemned to death. Deliver him to the Gentiles, to be mocked and flogged and crucified, and to be raised on the third day. As I said, I'm not sure how much the disciples really understood exactly what he was getting after. I don't know if they hear it as like motivational, you know, like give me liberty or give me death, or they can take our lives, but they can never take our freedom. This sort of like speech that Jesus is giving, not actually assuming he truly might die. When he says, like, I will die and I will rise again, and they're like, yeah, let's go beat them. I don't know if they think that way. But after every one, they have this weird interaction. The first one, Peter's like, no way, right? Jesus rebukes him and then tells him that he's not thinking heavenly, he's thinking too earthly, he's thinking like man. He's like, we have to take up our cross, guys, all of you, to lose your life, to give up everything. That is going to be gain. And the second one, the disciples come and ask, who's the greatest in the kingdom? And Jesus is like, children, that's the greatest in the kingdom. Become like them. And he flips it. And now we get to the third time. He talks about his death. And once again, we get this weird response. The mother of sons of Zebedee came up with her sons, and kneeling before him, she asked him something. James and John are these two. And the whole family seems to be following. He says, what do you want? She said to him, say that the two sons of mine may sit, one at your right hand, one at your left. So Jesus asked her, Tithalais, this, what do you want? What is that you want from me? And we'll come back because that question comes up again. And I do think she's just advocating for her sons here, requesting sort of the vice president positions in Jesus' cabinet here. And Jesus answered, you don't know what you're asking. Are you able to drink the cup that I'm able to drink? Now, I agree. I sort of doubt that the disciples knew exactly what Jesus was talking about here, of what cup Jesus is actually referring to here. But if you're a good disciple of a rabbi, we covered this when Peter gets a walking on water. If your rabbi does something, what should be the expectation? That you do the same thing. So if Jesus is going to drink the cup, you're like, whatever that cup is, Jesus, if I'm your disciple, my expectation is I drink that cup too. So I think they're right to say, we are able. Yes, Jesus, we will do whatever it is we're supposed to do. And he said to them, you will drink my cup. And I think he's saying, yeah, you guys will die at the hands of living for my kingdom. But to sit at my right hand and left hand is not mine to grant. It's for those for whom it has been prepared by my Father. And when the 10 heard this, they were indignant at the two brothers. Now, I don't know if they were Why they were indignant? Perhaps they were thinking, I should have thought about that. They missed out their opportunity of asking first, or maybe they just thought these two were totally out of line, or their mom was totally out of line, whatever it was, but they're indignant. And Jesus called to him and said, you know the rulers of the Gentiles. And sometimes when we read Gentiles, we immediately think of Greeks, but you can easily substitute the word nations for the word Gentiles quite often. And so you know the rulers of the Gentiles, or you know the nations and how people work. They lord it over them. And the great ones exercise authority over them. It shall not be so among you. For whoever would be great among you must be your servant. Whoever is first among you must be your slave. Even as the Son of Man did not... came not to be served, but to serve and give his life as a ransom for many. So Jesus gathers his disciples in this moment. Whatever they're thinking, whatever is going on between the 10 and the 2 and the question that the mom asked, he wants to gather them and teach them this lesson. And essentially he's like, look, there's a way the world works. There's an authority that the world functions out of. It's a long Greek word. I'm not even going to try to pronounce it. But there's an authority. And he's essentially like, that's how the nations work. Like, you guys know how, like Caesar, you guys have seen Caesar, you know how this works. You've seen the Romans, you've seen the Greeks, you've seen the Egyptians. We see it all over. Guys, that's how power, that's how it works. And he says, but not so with you guys. What I'm calling you to do and to be is not like how the rest of the world functions. If you guys want to think about greatness, go be a servant. You want to think about who's first, go think about slavery. And Jesus points him to himself as the very model of this. He says, the Son of Man, the great exalted one out of the book of Daniel, who's given dominion and power and kingdom, he has not come demanding power and dominion and kingdom, but to serve and to give his life. And I want to camp out quite a bit today on just this concept of power and authority and dominion and the words we use around those things. Because, hear me, we're surrounded by it all the time. It's the systems that we live in. It's how all of us function, right? Like, my wife and I have a tire with a leak in it right now. When we go to the tire place, they have authority, right? And whatever they say, no matter how much I'm like, I think you're ripping me off, they have authority and they're wielding it. Or a doctor has authority when you go and see them. Or even a traffic light has authority to tell us to stop or to not stop. Now the traffic light itself, you may be like, doesn't have the authority, but there's a power behind it. There's the police force and there's other things. And there's all these dynamics that we wield all the time and they affect us. They're in systems and structures all over the place. They're individually within us or our households and all these things. And we tell stories all the time about power and the redemption of that power, right? Like Spider-Man, with great power comes what? Great responsibility, right? Yes. It's an important lesson. And all of our superhero movies are like about yielding power or not, and how do we do those things? Lord of the Rings, as I said, is already a storytelling in that vein of what is power. And we're also in a postmodern world. Like, these conversations around power are super elevated right now. Is power always evil? Can it be used for good? Is any authority over a person an evil thing? Is power essentially the same, but it could be wielded for good or evil, just depending on who has it, or control, or influence. All these great debates that I think are good and healthy that we're having about power and authority, and particularly against those who maybe lack power or lack agency, and how we have those conversations are important conversations. Or maybe how we look at politics, right? Thoughts right now is that we need, right, coercive legislation power. We need to get the right people in office who agree with our particular sets of values. We need to fight back against the ideological encroachment against the other side, whatever our political enemies may be. Right? And both sides talk like that. And the standard account of power says there's only one kind of power in the world. And we, the good people, we must get on the right side of it, using it to bring justice to the world. But power is power. It's the way the world works. There's no getting around it. So let's get the good people in charge of that power and putting it to work towards some kind of righteous end, right? That's how the world speaks of it. But I wonder, and I've been more convicted about this over the last couple years, what the Bible says about power actually is distinctly different. David Fitch put out a book recently called A Reckoning with Power. And it's not a long read, but it's a wonderful read. He starts a little slow, but he really gets going. And he boils down some of these biblical concepts and argues that there's the way we often think about power may not be wrong, and that perhaps there's really two different actual kinds of power. There's power over, which is actually the word in the Greek. It actually is like this overpower kind of language. And it's the ability to get something done despite resistance, like coercion, violence, or even complicity in social systems, the power of police officers, power of physicians, or car mechanics, power of expertise. When you feel powerless in that relationship, it's privilege, it's social pressure. Most of our laws function this way, right? And it makes sense. Even tradition, military, so many things that we would identify as like, this is what power looks like. It's the most common form we operate in. And now hear me, not all of that's bad. I'm not up here to say like power over is always a terrible thing, right? It has a role to preserve life or to do certain things. My wonder is if that's not explicitly Christian though. And what I mean by that is that power has little power to actually like change the world. It can restrain some things, like a traffic light does. But is that what Jesus is inviting us really into? And along with Fitch, along with folks like Andy Crouch and Greg Boyd and Scott McKnight, Marva Dawn, others have been talking about this. They speak about ideas of power over versus either power under or power with, depending on who you're reading. This idea of mutual submission, reciprocity in relationships. Power that is at work in initiating forgiveness. It's the power of Jesus in his stories where he's like, look, I can call down 72,000 angels right now. But no, I'm giving my life. You don't take it from me, but I give it. And we see this picture throughout scripture because it's really easy to go, all right, but right from page one, we're told to rule and subdue. Like, power over. Well, maybe. Because there's different words for rule. Like by chapter four, when it starts talking about, or chapter three, when it starts talking about Adam and his sin, he's gonna talk about, his desire is gonna be to rule over. It's a whole different word. It's not the same word that's used for how Adam and Eve would rule over creation. And we also see a picture of rule right from Genesis 1 as well in how God rules. Even in God's creation actions, when he says, let us do these things, they're not imperatives. You almost expect it, right? If you have this all-powerful God over the universe, he'd be like, I demand light, I demand creation, I demand earth, appear, those sort of things. But he uses, the writers or the group of writers, whoever is behind Genesis 1, uses the justive tense, which is what we translate, let there be light. It would be like at the banquet of a king. And one way the king could bring out the meal is say, slaves, bring the food out now. Or he could say, let us feast. And it's a way to express desire and invitation in the very language that you use. And Genesis 1 uses this justice case where gods and kings command everything with power over. The choice of justice, I think, is really important. And the same thing is even true with the image-creating nature of Genesis 1. The Imago Dei, the image that Adam and Eve is created for. Now, there's only two things in ancient world that carry the image of God. One is any statue that exists inside a temple. It's the image of the god. So some statue of Ra, when you go to the temple, that is the image of the god. And the other way it got used is around kings and pharaohs. So a pharaoh would be the image of some sort of certain god, like almost a reflection of that god in human form. That's it. Those are the images. So when Genesis 1 comes along and says, men, women, Adam, Eve, male, female, y'all are the image of God. I mean, that's like ancient world dynamite thrown into scripture. I mean, it is backwards. That God creates man and woman and gives what is a reserved power for the highest beings or the highest person in all of society and goes, humanity, that's the power I'm giving you. And there's an invitation to participate. Because God created the world good, and he could finish that work and make it perfect or great or whatever would be the finale. But he creates and he says, hey, I'm inviting you into this project for us to do together. Cooperation, invitation, shared enjoyment, shared authority, given even freedom to disobey in the garden. And that's just page one. And we'll see this all throughout scripture, right? Like Paul will say about Jesus, they disarmed the powers and the authorities and made them a public spectacle. And sometimes I'm like, what? How is that a public spectacle? It seemed like the spectacle was Jesus is losing. But then I think about the stories afterwards, right? It's almost like the ultimate dig. Like if you get someone's worst attack and then you just act like it was no big deal, that's like the ultimate flaunting of like authority, right? Friday he conquers death, Saturday he conquers hell, Friday he conquers sin, Saturday he conquers hell, Sunday he conquers death. And what does he go do? King of kings, Lord of lords, authority over all the universe, he goes and cooks breakfast for his friends. Right? That's what he goes and does. It's like, hey, how about come by the campfire and let's have breakfast together. It's like, that's the power of the universe, conquering death, having breakfast with his disciples. It's unmasking the powers and principalities. That the gentle and lowly, the meek and humble, is truly the power that conquers the evil of the world. I mean, we constantly see it. The experience of Jesus in the desert, the temptation by the devil, is what? It's all about power over. Here, you can have power over your father. You can manipulate him because he's not going to let you fall off this tower. He'll protect you. Or you can have all the kingdoms of this world. You can have all this dominion. You can have all these things. It's constantly this temptation for power over. Or disciples are like, hey, this city treated us poorly. Do you want us to call down fire upon them? And Jesus is like, no. You're missing it. You're missing the point. Or Peter draws his sword when Jesus gets arrested at the end of the story. On the night Jesus gets arrested, he pulls it out, slices off the ear. And Jesus is like, this is not the way, guys. And he will even talk to Pilate about that very fact. John 18:36, he has this interaction with Pilate, the Roman authority at the time. And Pilate's asking him about his kingdom, and Jesus is like, are you asking me, or did someone put those ideas in your head? And Jesus ultimately answers, he says, my kingdom is not of this world. So it's not just, my kingdom's not in this world, it's just not of it. It's not of the same flavor, it's not of the same kind as this world. My kingdom were of this world, my servants would have been fighting, that I might not be delivered over to the Jews, but my kingdom is not of this world. In the normal setting, the kingdoms of this world, how this would normally work to any other kingdom is that all my people would end up in violence and trying to overthrow things and just trying to destroy. They would end up in power over. But that's not how this is working. My kingdom is not of this world. Or even, because it's really easy to be like, what about like driving out demons and that's power over and all these kind of things, which is great. There's dunamis, it's a lot about miracles and power that exists there. But I even love, Jesus sends out the 72. It's a wonderful story. Sends them out. It's like, I'm giving you all authority. Go drive out demons. Go preach the gospel. Go do all these things. And they come back and they're like, Jesus, you won't believe it. We drove out demons. We had all this kind of power. It was incredible. And Jesus is like, cool, guys. But he says this to them. Do not rejoice in this, that the spirits are subjected to you. He's like, don't get so excited about all that. So rejoice that your names are written in heaven. Disciples, your rejoicing was not about power, but rather that the display just confirms that you are under God's authority, that you are under the king. That's the point, disciples. And they always need to be reminded. It was constant in their walking that they need to be reminded that this power over, this sort of upside down way that the world sort of functions and how Jesus' kingdom functions needed to be corrected in their mind. And the difficulty is that, like, this power over, this way that often we think about power and authority. It has a very limited function in God's world. The power under, I think, is what Jesus is really inviting his disciples into this text to go, I need you to think very differently about power and authority. Power over does not redeem, it does not love, it does not forgive, it does not reconcile. It does not change the world. And I think the tragedy right now is that many Christians believe that power over is the way to bring about God's plan on earth. It's a wonderful question. Can Christians ever use power over? Should Christians ever use this sort of authority to sort of coerce or to do certain things? And some would say yes, yeah, because there's only one kind of power, so we need people of good character and highly accountable systems, and we need to set that up really well. Sure. Or you go the path of like a Luther or an Augustine, or Augustine if you're a seminary nerd. It's worldly power governs politics and economics. Godly power is about human individuals and saints. It's sort of the two-kingdom picture of things, city of God, city of man. The godly power doesn't do anything in worldly systems. The worldly power should be avoided in godly systems. Perhaps. Or we have to use power over for justice, right? We need to fix the broken things of this world, so we need power over to help actually enact those things. But even that gets oddly messy when we start talking about privilege and all these kind of things, because it's often still the people in power who are the gatekeepers of how to redistribute privilege to the world in a way that's still power over, still holding the cards while inviting other people by choice. Or we need to use power over because humans are evil, right? This is where Romans 13, if you know the text, it's a little bit, it's like this small segment about government and how we should view the government. It gets deployed. And there is something to that, right? It's for stoplights and cops and things that are banned and outlawed. They're good things. There's nothing wrong with those things. The issue is tricky when Christians start thinking that this is one of the ways that people get healed or redeemed or transformed. The power over can preserve life, but that is all it can do. The other power is how the kingdom unleashes. I think there's a place for power over, but it is not Christian power. And we have to be very clear on the appropriate use of what its aims are for when we start thinking in very worldly power ways. And as Christians, I think we have to sort of eschew power over completely. It's not just about the right people and power over. It's the nature of what power over actually is like and what it does to the world. Like, and I know this is not the MO of our church, but it's also like, I hear Christian nationalism and it makes no sense in line with what Jesus actually teaches of how power functions in the world. Because there's so many implications, right? Like justice issues. This is what made MLK Jr. a powerful force. Because he sees love and reconciliation as a legitimate power to change the world, right? Not seeking violence, not seeking those things. Or the guy, I mean, it's a tremendous story if you've never heard it. There's this one black man who has entered into relationship with hundreds of current or former Ku Klux Klan members. And the stories that come out of his experience of these lives that are changed. I mean, you could sit there and outlaw and say, hey, Ku Klux Klan members can't go burning crosses on and intimidating tactics and stuff like that. But that doesn't change a heart, right? Just outlaw certain things. There's no transformation. But the power that is unleashed in enemy-loving, nonviolent way of Jesus, the power that is unleashed when people confront sin and forgive and confess and all these things, that is how the world changes. Once again, it's even related to this concept of privilege. It's a good direction to go, hey, those of us that might have more privilege or power for various reasons, it's really good to bring along people that don't and help give them voices. But then it gets a little messy when we become the gatekeepers of who we actually pick to come into the story. And it's messy. There's dynamics in that. I think the implication, too, is that we have to be careful that we don't codify power over in our hierarchies in church, family, and all these things. I think sometimes we get to Genesis 3 and 4, and we have now codified it as if that's the way that God actually desires things to be. And it gets messy. I mean, so much has been written lately. Whether it's someone like Jamar Tisby or Kristen Dumez or others who just talk about the mess of how power over has been wielded by the church and the systems that run the church. And perhaps it's worthwhile for us to look at the very structures, the very hierarchy, the authority issues that we have in our church. It's like every week there's another scandal, right? Every week there's some other pastor that has wielded authority really poorly, or just another thing that just caused you to shake your head and we're like, why does this keep happening? Are these just a few bad apples in the church world? Or is there something woven deeply into the fabric of how we do church here in America that leads again and again to these type of moral failings where we're like, what is going on? Perhaps we need a careful examination about it all. I want to address something just because I know is a conversation at the women's retreat. So one of the things that I do here that I was hoping not to draw any attention to, but now it feels helpful to address it. So every other week, I empty all the trash in the building and I scrub toilets that need to be scrubbed. And hear me, I'm fine with it. Because I would argue, of all the things I do as a pastor, there's nothing more like Jesus than probably those moments. They're just hard. And I read a text like this and I said, I should keep cleaning toilets. It's great. I'm honored that some of you want to go, hey, you shouldn't be doing that. I'm honored by that. Hear me. But I think it's really important. I shouldn't have my own little parking spot. I shouldn't have security or whatever else some churches do for their path. No. And hear me, that plays out for all of y'all, right? It's just servanthood. That's what Jesus invites us into. You're never more like Jesus sometimes when you're changing the diaper of your kid. Or coming alongside someone grieving. Or helping to bathe an aging parent. Or walking with someone experiencing a disability or a child that's experiencing a disability. Or bearing patiently with a family member with a mental illness, whatever it is. That may be the most Jesus-like part of your life right now. And that's wonderful. Celebrate it. It may not feel that way. You may feel like, oh, I just want to go out and share the gospel and change the world, stuff like that. But Jesus is like, look, you want to talk about greatness? Go. Go be a servant. I think it has implications of prayer that we are these relational beings and God invites us in to co-participate with him. It's always like, well, does God actually answer prayers if he already knows things? And what's the point of that? And I think it's this. It's this God saying, look, I'm inviting you into the way power works. I'm inviting you into participating in how I'm working in the world. I think it affects how we think about laws and politics. I'll get fully controversial on this one. Take an issue like abortion. Is the goal of God in the world to outlaw abortion, or is the goal of God in the world to create an alternative where abortion is no longer attractive to begin with? Those are different things. And the argument for overturning Roe v. Wade is to preserve life. Hear me, I am all for preserving life. All about it. I want to be as pro-life as I can be. But perhaps it's a picture more of pro-life, to be committed to women, young women, single moms, socially vulnerable, economically vulnerable, and provide safety nets and structures and support for those choices that lead to pro-life outcomes. There's two different things. I'm glad, I mean, we outlawed Roe v. Wade. Guess what? There was an uptick in abortions. So maybe power over isn't actually the solution. And maybe there's other ways to really think about how God transforms the culture in the world. And all of this is tied into, like, sometimes we think about the idea of, like, giving God glory. It's something, language we use in the church. Like, for many of us, it's like, giving God glory is recognizing I'm a worm and God is really great and he's some kind of cosmic narcissist that just really needs me to say how great he is. But God is glorified when the gifts that he gives to this world are enjoyed, where we come along, when humans function in the world in the image and character and goodness of God in a world that's reflective of his kinship. That is glory. And he gives us power to go do that. And lastly, we need very communal habits for all this to happen. Like, even platforming, even the stage, even my role or singers or whatever, like, it's an expression at times of power over. And we need to think through habits that bring out mutuality and reciprocity and plurality and all these things to the community. Like, if you're a person that's been hurt by the church, maybe you're even visiting with us today, hurt by the church, you're skeptical and stuff like that, cool. I hope you don't judge fully how great the church is or not by this, like, 40 minutes. But look for the communal life. Look for a community that practices humility, embracing weakness and isolation and limitation, or in shared practices and skepticism towards hierarchy and stuff like that. It's probably a really good community in the life of the church that keeps Jesus at the center of it all, certainly, but that practices all those things. And I love the closing text here. As I went out of Jericho, great cloud followed, two blind men by the roadside. When they heard Jesus passing by, they cried out, "Lord, have mercy on us, Son of David." And the crowd, exercising power over, telling them to be silent, they cried out all the more, "Lord, have mercy on the Son of David." And Jesus, stopping, called them and said, he doesn't say, "Clearly you're blind, and I know what you need, and I'm going to do it." That's not what he says. He asked the same question that he asked the wife of Zebedee. He said, "What do you want me to do for you?" And in that moment, instilling dignity, agency to these two men. And sometimes, I mean, it's what we run into in this part in this shopping center all the time. Sometimes I'm like, here's what those guys need. I know what they need. But perhaps the starting point is to simply go, "Hey, what do you want me to do for you?" And then so it's still this wonderful moment of agency and care. That would be our approach, that we enter into spaces with just hands open. Walking into rooms going, "How can I be a servant in this room? How can I be least in this room?" There's a list. How can I be last on that list? It is in there, in those places, I think we become most like Jesus. And we use the very things that Jesus has given us to change the world. Yes, he's given us incredible power by the Spirit. Absolutely. But he's like, "Here's how I want you to express it. Completely different than how the world thinks. Go upside down with it. Whatever you think about authority and how everybody talks about authority, flip it. That's how I want you to live." And that's what the cross was. There's so many ways Jesus could have died. Thousands and thousands of ways. Some of them even more symbolic than the cross could have been in different ways. Like, could have staggered into the Holy of Holies and bled on them. Oh, I mean, there's so many cool things that could have been the story. He's like, "Let's take this shameful cross that's going to be a stumbling block to the Jews. It's going to be foolishness to the Gentiles, because they're going to look at that and go, well, that's like the lowest of the low. What a terrible way, like, the story could have ended." And he's like, "Yeah, that's when I became king, guys." And how backward that really is. And in that, pays for sin, dies, and invites us in to be citizens. And to actually give us a new mind. And even as Romans, no, I'm totally going off script, I know I need to stop, but like, Romans spends chapters and chapters and chapters just unpacking just wonderfully rich theology. And Paul's like, application then is, so don't be like the world. You know now how the world thinks. You need a renewed mind, and it's going to manifest in how you just love everybody, and how you show hospitality, how you do all these mundane, relational, yet upside down things. So as we've been redeemed, we are invited now into just the weird, unique, upside down way of Jesus.